Hello and welcome to the Recreation to Recreation podcast, the show where we explore the stories of people who have turned the activity that they love into positive change for our world. My name is Jen, and I'll be your sidekick on this adventure as we treasure hunt for gems of insight and wisdom while exploring the planet with our inspiring guests. For today's adventure, we're heading to California and beyond with Tamara to explore her world of poetry, presence, and teaching. Hi, Tamara. How are you today?
Hi, Jen. I'm good. How are you?
I am so good and very excited to be here with you. So I'm wondering if you could tell us where you are, what it's like there, and get us situated in your world.
Sure. I live in Long Beach, California. I live a half a mile from the beach. I live in this beautiful oasis of my community. When I tell my students or friends or people I meet about my neighborhood, I hear words like idyllic, and it sounds like this little fantasy land, and it really is quite ideal. So I'm deeply rooted here, and we've got lots of different representations of groups in my community. For the last few years, of course, during pandemic lockdown, I was teaching from my home, which really just further solidified my commitment here. Moving forward, now that I'm back in the classroom, it's just kind of been an interesting transition. So that's where I am. Do you want me to say my age or my profession?
You can say whatever you like. This is your interview.
Well, I'll be 57 this year in August, and I've been teaching at my campus, Fullerton College, which is a community college in Orange County, for 27 years. Overall teaching for 30. That's enough intro, I think.
Hearing you talk about your community, how long have you lived in that community?
That is a really good question that I'm trying to figure out. I think I moved here when I was 42, so that's 15 years. Yeah, it's really cool. I kind of mark my time here by my garden. I was like, oh yeah, that tree wasn't here that's now supporting a swing. And, you know, kind of like, oh yeah, this was when we used to have this palm, this date palm in the front. So I kind of have been marking my time here based on my garden, which is another big part of my community, and because I run a neighbor crop swap from my garden and my neighbor's garden. So yeah.
Well, I think that is a beautiful way to mark time. And I can't wait to talk more about that later. We are definitely going to be delving into some gardening. So people may be like, what are you talking about? You said poetry, presence, and teaching. I'm like, well, just wait for it. But before we dive in, I'd love to start with my weird and wonderful questions. So okay. I hope you're ready for this. They're always a little...
Oh, I'm ready.
Yeah, they're always a bit of an adventure. I just love them so much.
I ask my students a roll call question every day as a way they have to sign in their questions that I'm assuming or expecting are going to be similar to the ones you're about ready to ask me. So I'm ready.
Perfect. She's prepared. Here we go. What is the last song that you listened to?
Oh, that is not what I expected. But that's a great... I'm going to get all these for roll call questions, so no, fine.
Don't worry, I can send them to you in an email.
I'm trying to think. What was the last... I'm looking at my playlist, which is a bizarre...
Not one that you want to share? Is it a guilty pleasure?
No. It's not, I'm not embarrassed, but it's just odd because I've kind of been on this kick lately. You Better You Bet by The Who.
What a great song.
That came from some playlist that showed up. And I was like, oh my gosh, I remember that song because the guy who drove me to high school, my sophomore year, I used to drive to school with a Camaro full of guys, most of them Italian. And they were just like big brothers. They were awesome. He was a Who fan, a Who and a Beatles fan. So we used to listen to You Better, You Better, You Bet almost every day for like 4 months. So when I heard this song, I was like, oh, it's so Jake Charmello and Tony and Catanzarini and, you know, whatever. So then I was like, I really like The Who. I forget about them And that's kind of what I've been experiencing with a lot of different things. It's like, oh, I forget how much I like this. Mm. I'm kind of on this journey right now to really dig into what I like and what really feeds my soul and is my thing. And you bet by the Who, I guess, is one of those things. So that's the lesson.
Amazing. I love how music can just transport us back to, you know, times in our lives. That's hilarious. I love that story. And I am also just really happy. I knew this already, but to hear you just on a journey of joy, basically discovering the things that make you feel good. So I think more of us could be making that a priority.
Yeah, I'm so glad I am.
Okay. What's your favorite thing about cooking?
Oh, gosh. I love the sensuousness of it. Why am I getting all choked up about this? Like, I'm getting tears. Mm. It's just such a way to connect. It's a way of getting into flow. So for me, it's a meditation. Mm. And that sensuous part of it is really important. I know that in my practices, the ones I connect with most are often sensory-based practices. So for me, it's just, there's such a flow and a rhythm, and it's the feeling of the food in your hand when you're cooking and preparing. And I also love, it's another part of me and my orientation to the world. I like to be prepared for things. So sometimes I'll spend a lot of mental energy preparing. Like, I find that when I'm in practices, when my mind wanders, it's wandering to prep for something. Mm-hmm. And I've semi-joked, more serious than joking, I've said that I have every tool you can imagine for a kitchen, including an angel food cake cutter. What? I get so much pleasure out of having every tool. I must have said at least 50 times, I just love having exactly the tool I need for every job in the kitchen, no matter what it is. I don't know why that is, but I do. So sometimes, and this is how silly I am, I have a pot rack. It's kind of tucked away in my kitchen. And so you can't see, it's like kind of like behind the refrigerator on the other side of the refrigerator. And people don't always see it, but when they see it, they're like, wow. I'm like, mm-hmm. Every single pot there, every pan, every roaster, colander, everything gets polished and washed every time I use it, which is like cuckoo. I realize that's like crazy obsessive, but there is a pleasure in that I cannot describe. So sometimes I'll just go in and look at my pots. Sometimes I'll just open my drawer of all my crazy tools. And it just fills me. I don't know why. I could probably go into that, but I'd have to pay you good money for that. But I love it. So I think it's just the complete immersion of myself in that task. Mm. I mean, the outcome is so wonderful because it is rare that I cook something just for myself. Like my neighbors, I'll call them over, I'll text them, I'll say, I'm making some pasta, get your boiling water ready, because I like to make, I have a pasta maker, so. Mm-hmm. Or I made this soup, bring your bowls over. You know, I mean, the outcome is so wonderful to share, and food is just such a primary, it's an indulgence, it's a necessity, and I just be able to bring people together around that. It's just wonderful. So what don't I love? What is not my favorite thing about? I even like doing the dishes. So I don't know. I love grocery shopping. That's crazy. But I do. I love grocery shopping. I was shopping for my neighbors during the pandemic. I'm like, I'll pick up your groceries. Anyways, that's
Oh, I love it. This was very representative of why I chose the word presence for this interview. And also fits in very well with your journey to joy that you're on and finding the things that you love. And also that love comes in so many different shapes and forms, right? It doesn't have to be in the sort of more typical ways that we understand it, but that joy and that deeper love for things, that passion that we have for things can come out everywhere when we allow it to.
Yeah.
Okay. What's the best day of the week?
Oh my gosh, I just asked this question to my class last That is so funny. The best day of the week. Well, in the summertime or in during the semester, during my work week, I would say probably either Thursday or Friday, because I teach Monday through Thursday. So Thursday is kind of like my Friday, and I get that joy of late afternoon, like, oh, I'm done and I don't have anything tomorrow. No, I usually do. Or Friday, because Friday's my day to grocery shop, like I said, and to do all my house chores, which I'm a total house chores lover. Anything nesting, I love it. Friday, maybe Friday then, because I get to do all my chores. I usually get to do fun things. I spend my time usually in the garden that I curate for a local restaurant. Sometimes I'll go for a swim if it's warm, and or I'll have my boat out. So yeah, I would say Friday.
Amazing. I feel like I have some sense of the answer for this next question, but I'm excited to see it. What is the best thing about where you live?
Oh, geographically, it's the beach. But community, it's my neighbors. Everything grows here. People have said, like, you have the greenest thumb. It's like, it's not me. Trust me. Like, you could grow anything here. I can grow orchids here. I can grow gardenias here. I can grow roses here. And I think it's just because of my proximity to the ocean and just that beautiful damp air. Always got some humidity in the air, which is nice. The beach here in Long Beach isn't that great. But the next two cities over, it's like, oh my gosh, just spectacular. So I'll head down to Sunset Beach usually when I want a good beach day. But recently I've been on my boat, so I just get to have my beach day just out on the ocean. No beach, just ocean.
I think there's a reason why people choose their holidays by the ocean, right? We crave time by the water. So being able to live close to the ocean must be such a gift. But also, let's give you a little bit of credit for how you nurture your plants. Yes, the nature is there, but you also nurture them. I know you do. The love that you bring to everything. So let's give you a little bit of credit there.
Sweet. Thank you.
What is something that scares you that you'd like to overcome?
Ugh, that's a no-brainer for me. When I was finishing up my program, I think my undergrad, I started experiencing anxiety. And then I had full-blown panic attacks once I started my job at the college I'm at right now, and my father had passed a few months prior, completely unexpectedly. And he was really my anchor in the world. So as a result, I stopped driving on freeways. I couldn't fly on airplanes, and I couldn't ride on elevators. It was that whole locked in, that claustrophobia. So I've overcome flying. I love to fly because I lead trips with an education travel company, and I'm fine in elevators. But the freeway, I mean, I drive the freeways for work, but I don't drive freeways that I don't know, because it'll launch me into a full anxiety moment if I can't get off the freeway, like at the shoulder. It has any kind of construction, or there's any of those little barricades. So about a year and a half ago, I actively was trying to overcome that and get more comfortable. But as my schedule increased in complexity, I have put that on the back burner. But that is a fear that I would love to overcome.
Well, I look forward to some road trips together then.
Whoa, Jen. Oh, you just committed.
I will happily be your little sidekick for getting over that fear. That is fine. I'm happy to be there. Okay, one more question and then we're into the thick of it.
Okay.
What's your favorite form of exercise?
Swimming. Mm-hmm. Oh no, ballet dancing. Dancing in general. I'm just started taking ballet 6 months ago, if even that. No, like 3 months. And it is just, I love to dance. I would have to say dancing. I love to swim though, too. To me, swimming is dancing in water. So it's great. But I love the challenge of partner dancing. I was a swing dancer for a number of years. And so I used to go a couple times a week to the Derby up in Hollywood. And I had a place every night of the week if I wanted. Mm-hmm. And I knew just different dancers. And to be able to let go and just get into the flow with somebody else, it was fantastic, as I'm sure you're thinking the relative other activity that you get into flow with another person physically.
They are both a type of dance.
They are. But I loved it. I remember a friend of mine seeing me. This is a friend I worked with, Animal Rescue. And so she knows how much I love animals. And she'd seen me around that all the time. And she'd seen me do poetry readings and things. But she saw me dance once. And she said, "I have never seen you so happy." Mm. I love to dance. So yeah.
Well, I'm glad you started up ballet classes again then.
Me too. And I'd never done ballet. So it was completely different, which is fantastic. It's physically exhausting and it's equally mentally exhausting, which I absolutely go cuckoo for.
Between swimming and dancing, as you said, swimming is like dancing in the water, but they're both about grace and elegance and they're full body exercise. Everything gets its turn.
Yeah. It's everything. Yeah.
You can see why I love these weird and wonderful questions. So many jumping off points that I'm now like, oh, okay, I want to talk about that. We got to talk more about that.
Yeah.
But before we do that, I always like to start these interviews with a bit of an origin story. So let's take it back. Who are you? How did life begin? And what has it been like being Tamara?
So origin story, I think I would start myself really in a deep community, which is the origin of the life I have cultivated now. And I was just wondering this the other day. I know parts of our personalities are ascribed to genetics, but my mom has always been a big community advocate and interactive. And I grew up, again, the same kind of idyllic experience and situation. I had a block of like 30 kids. And this was the late 60s, early 70s. And so kids were just like stray dogs. You just ran around and you made friends and you played until, as people in my generation are noted to say, until the streetlights came on. You go home when it's dark. And I really would play outside all day. And sometimes after dark in the summertime, be out playing with my neighbors and we would play, you know, kick the can, over the line, badminton, pickle. My house was right in the middle. So they'd come and meet at my house. So, and my brother and sister and I mean, there were three kids across the street, four kids down the street. There were about six kids across the way down the street. There were 10 kids, four doors down to the right. And then next door, there were six kids. But it was middle class 1970s suburbs. Mm-hmm. So my neighbors were my godparents and their six kids. I mean, they babysat me and one of them taught me to walk when she was babysitting. See, my parents were furious. The last kid. But she's like, look, your baby's walking. I think my origin story is about community. And it's just kind of what I know. What's it been like being Tamara? It's been a journey for sure. I've been thinking about this kind of like the trajectory of my life. It's like a life review before, hopefully, a long time, my death. Mm-hmm. I think I had that initial experience. And then I was the youngest on the block. So they all moved away. And then my parents divorced. And then it was just me. And that was really hard. And I think I lacked the analysis or analytical abilities to see that is my core. Like, I need that. So it wasn't until I moved here 15 years ago, I think we decided, that I really until my 40s, that I realized that's what I need to create. And once I came here in this community, and there's been, you know, different iterations of this group, but always a support, always, always. My former neighbor is a community activist. He runs a community nonprofit here in Long Beach. He started Dog Beach. He does turkey trot, everything. I can't even begin to tell you all the things he does. And when he moved, I was devastated. And that's when I saw the opportunity. He used to run a book swap here. And I thought, well, I want to do something that's going to keep the community coming by, that's going to have that same flow and energy or flow of energy. So I decided to do a crop swap. And that's how that started, because I was already very big into my garden. Actually, when he moved, I took him to the garden and I said, I want you to choose what you want to take with you to your new home. I took a blueberry plant and one of my jasmine plants and a couple others. So I think that my journey has been for the middle section of my life as it is now. It won't be the middle because right now is going to be the middle of my lifespan. But for the middle, 25 until 40 has been really deeply lonely and without even realizing it. I tried to build that community at my job and it worked for a long time until more recently it really didn't. So I'm so grateful to have it here at my home. My life was super joyful when I was young. I mean, I just so full of joy. All I remember is sunshine. All I remember is being at the beach with our beach parties and playing at night with my neighbor friends and outside on the patio with the barbecue and the garden and just walking the dog at night as a family and playing basketball and roller skating and bike riding and, you know, hopscotch and all that. It was so much joy. Mm-hmm. I mean,
it's okay.
I almost was going to say, I don't know how my little heart held all that joy.
Well, you're rediscovering parts of it now and piecing it back together, right?
Yeah. And it was just so beautiful. So beautiful. And I see a lot of that here now, which makes me very happy.
Yeah.
But so there were some dark decades in there. And that's okay. The world is, life is suffering. That's the truth, right? Really dig in.
Yeah, well, thank you so much for sharing that. I think it's so important for us to be vulnerable, even when it's something public, like going on a podcast. The more that we can demonstrate that we have a shared human experience, even though it comes in different shapes and forms, and no two experiences are the same. But I think, as you said, life comes with suffering. They go hand in hand, and it's part of what I like to believe that we signed up for, was to come here to feel the full spectrum of emotion that is available to us and in our human form. It's in times of suffering that we tend to discover who we are. I can imagine that it would have been a very lonely time for you. And I'm wondering, when I did some research before our episode recording today, I found this piece that said that you began writing at a young age and that you had kept a journal since you were 14, and you reread entries when you want a good laugh or need to be reminded of the virtue of humility.
Yeah.
Is that the time when you sort of discovered the power of writing just in your journal, or maybe it was poetry, or was that something that came later? I'm just curious about your journey with that part of your life.
I didn't realize this. When my sister got married, my brother was in town from Iowa for the wedding, and he had found these old cassette tapes of the three of us. I'm going to remind you, this is the 70s. So having a cassette recorder was like a big deal. Mm-hmm. Like, oh, you had the little plug-in microphone and, you know, the whole thing. It's nice. So we had recorded ourselves, and I was, I think, 5. And one of the recording, we were just howling listening to it. It was just fantastic. And now Tammy, which that's who I was then, Tammy's going to read a story that she wrote. And I'm like, wait, what? I was writing stories when I was 5? And I didn't know. Because at the time of listening, I was already an English professor, and I'd been a published poet, and I had, you know, literary magazines and stuff, but I did not know that I was a fiction writer when I was 5.
Mm.
Yeah, when I was 14, my parents hadn't split yet, but the block had kind of dissolved a little bit because they were all older. You know, they'd gone off to college and gotten married and everything. I was taking my sophomore English class, and we had to write poetry and keep a journal. And that's when I started. And this was before creative nonfiction was a genre. So they were just journals and not considered creative writing, but my poetry was. And when I was in high school, I loved language. I loved the orderliness of language, that it could take a moment and just put it all together and preserve it. And to me, there is some kind of neatness about that that I really respond to. Again, I think I mentioned earlier that I like to go in and look at all my pots hanging in a row. So this sense of order, I love. And that to me is what language was, being able to give order and shape to an experience or to an emotion, something happening inside of me. I just started writing poems there in that class. And then it got to the point where I just, as I was going through the rest of my high school years, and my parents did split the next year. And then, you know, all of the fallout of that, an amicable split, but a split just the same.
Yep.
And just such a loss. I also had a huge community when I was little at my church. It was just, again, idyllic. I used to run the 6 walks to church. I used to run to go for the kids' mass, to, you know, do anything I could, carry the offering. It was amazing. That's another podcast. But anyway, so that's another one. I actually have a creative nonfiction piece published called Faith. So I just started writing, and I became known as a poet when they asked if I would write some poems for the yearbook, and I did. That was great. And then I went to school, and I didn't want to be an English major because I didn't want to teach.
Sure.
Yeah, right? Ha ha. Okay. Everything. Because I was never the kid who played school. I was not the teacher. I was not the school marm. That was not my vibe. Mm-hmm. I liked school not well enough, but I had a choice. I'd rather be at the beach.
Right.
Rather be, you know, running around, making up dance routines with my sister, or, you know, playing with my stuffed animal collection. Oh, that's a whole nother. That's another podcast. But anyway, really inventive, really creative, very physically in my body. Like my neighbor, he nicknamed me Wearable Smith because I was just everywhere. I could climb a tree. I could run down the street. I'd be on my roller skates. It's like I had so much energy. So yeah, I transferred from community college where I had taken this life-changing poetry class Stephen Jama taught. It threw everything out the window, what I knew poetry to be, in the most delightful way. And then I transferred as a journalism major. And a year in, I thought, I hate this. And so I thought, well, what do I really want to study? And I thought, well, I love poetry. I love literature. I'll study that, but I don't want to be a teacher. I don't know what I'm going to do with this degree, but I'll do it. And that was very brave. I could not see an end result that appealed to me. I just thought, well, right now, I'm going to be happy. Right now, I'm going to study what I want to be studying and something will work out. Mm. So I did. And it was the first semester I just dove in, and I was an editor on the literary magazine, which got me to the faculty advisor, who was just this idol of mine. She said, well, you're going to MC the open mic, right? I'm like, oh, sure. Yeah. And I'm thinking, I hate public speaking. Like, I don't know how I'm going to do. There's no way I would say no. If she asked me to do something, I'd be like, yeah, sure. I'll, you know, walk through a blizzard for you. Yeah, sure. If it'll impress you, great. I was asked by another, that was Dorothy Barisi. I'm doing a lot of name dropping just in case anybody hears this and knows. And then Helen Saltman, she taught an amazing American literature course. And this is all in my undergrad at Cal State Northridge. Go Matadors. And she came to me and said, I'd like for you to be a writing coach or an advisor in this Writing Across the Curriculums program that was very new. This whole concept was very new that she was piloting. And she said, and you'll go into non-English classrooms across campus, and you'll work with the faculty, helping them create writing intensive courses, how they can get more writing into their courses. Mm. So I would go into these classes of my peers and I'd lead a writing workshop. How in the heck did I, someone who hates public speaking, I'm like, okay. And I remember, on that interview, she said, is there any, so we interviewed, you know, she interviewed me and whatever. And it was really only open to graduate students, but invited me. And then I said, okay, you know, is there any other question? And I said, well, it's just a comment. I just want to let you know that I'm not going to be very good at this. And I remember she said, I'm willing to take that chance.
Yep.
Yeah. And it's like, that's the way it goes, right? You know, teachers, more people remember an influential teacher than really any other form, maybe a coach, but really we get where we go oftentimes because a teacher notices us and believes in us when we don't believe in ourselves. And I had that happen same semester. I had someone come to me and say, do you want to be a writing center tutor? I'm like, nope. And they said, it pays, and it paid really well, twice as much as minimum wage. It pays and you get college credit. I'm like, okay. I realized that's where I got my idea of how I thought language and literature should be taught. And then I took Helen Saltman's program to my high school, my alma mater, and I said, I think you should do this. And they said, okay, we'll get you a stipend for helping the faculty in other disciplines like history. And these are my former teachers, helping them create writing intensive courses. And you can set up a peer tutoring lab situation. And I did. And then they had an opening at the school in English. Everybody said, you should go for it. And then I did. And I loved it. I absolutely loved it. I taught high school for 2 years. And I threw everything I had into that job. And I loved those kids fiercely. It was a rough school in the sense that we had a lot of our kids bust in from some pretty rough neighborhoods during the time of the LA riots, 92 to 94. I remember at summer school before I went to graduate school, and that was the summer of Rodney King and the LA riots and everything. It was just crazy. But those kids, man, they were good kids. They were such good kids. Yeah. And I knew I could not do that job the way I was doing it, which is the only way I knew how to do it. I couldn't do it indefinitely. And I thought, I don't want to be burned out. I don't want to have all the life stuff sucked out of me, which is what they needed. There was no way I wasn't going to give it to them. If you asked me to go to your basketball game, your Eagle Scout coronation, your confirmation, your whatever, I'll be there. I'll be there. For 2 years, applied to graduate school, got in and out as fast as I could, and then taught community college ever since. I knew I wanted to teach community college because one of my dear, dear friends, my music professor in college, community college, James Hurd, who I'm still dear friends with to this day. Again, all these moments when teachers impact our lives and they see something in us or we see something in them, there's that, I don't know, that nurturing. So, yeah.
That's what this is all about, right? Is the ability to look at things as little points on a map over time. And we go back, we see like, how did this all come together? And you said it earlier in the interview, that very often the only time, and not us personally, if it's our time to go, but the only time we really sort of see this great reflection on life trajectory is usually in an obituary. And I remember that so vividly at my grandfather's funeral, looking at and reading his obituary and sort of saying, that led to that, and that's how that came about. And the thing that's so important about having, I guess, living obituaries, taking the time to reflect back, is that it's not someone else looking into your life and seeing the surface level of those points on the map. It's an invitation for you to look back and see the depth of the experiences that happened that aren't just those points, but everything around it. For me, listening to you talk about it, just a first reflection is you referred to that period of time in your life as dark and lonely. And yet you chose, the same as you are doing now, the journey of joy. You chose to do things because you loved doing them, even though you didn't know what the outcome was going to be. That is bravery, right? And that's something that we all have the choice in our daily life, in the small little things, and then in those bigger choices. And that's why I think having these reflection sessions, and even though we're reflecting on your life, it will resonate in some shape or form for the people listening, right? There's always going to be parts of the shared human experience. Oh, right. I also felt like that at one point. And all right, okay, and she did it this way. Well, maybe I could do it my own way. It's just invitations for us to experience life a little bit deeper.
We were just talking about this in my creative writing class. One of my students asked, like, well, did he intend to do this? And I said, well, what do you think? I realize I'm of a different generation. I've got 30 years on these kids of lived experience. And I said, I've always taught this class with this idea that what a wonderful opportunity that I am beginning to question everything about my teaching, everything. The institution, I've always questioned the institution, actually, but and I asked, I mean, that was point blank the question, like, what's my way in with you guys? I need to know who you are because I don't want to waste 14 weeks trying to figure out who you are. But we were talking about literature and I said, myself as a poet, I have an intention and I'm very clear. I said, so when I hear people say, oh, poetry is like, whatever, it's up for interpretation. I'm like, nope, it's not. I have a goal as a writer. And I asked them, do you guys have goals? Do you have intentions? I said, because that's how I'm teaching this class, that you have an intention and I'm going to try and help you get there. I want to know what that intention is because it's not my work. I want to know what you want it to be. And then I can give you feedback that guides and tells you, well, this is my experience of this work. And is that what you wanted? Again, this idea that, of course, the minute we start crafting our work for an audience, there's a different lens we're looking through. Private pieces and there's public pieces. I always teach that. And know the difference because your audience will appreciate it.
It's kind of like being discerning with what you share, right? Am I sharing this for me? Am I sharing it for the benefit of everyone? It's a very important question to ask yourself.
Considering, like you were saying, yes, I'm talking about my life and the details of it. And this is a very indulgent thing for me to do. And that's how I'm taking this. Understanding that I don't live in a bubble. And that's, I remember my student said this, gosh, 12 years ago, because she was writing creative nonfiction. That was like the new genre. She's like, there's a war going on. Why does anybody care about my struggles with math? And I said, well, let's ask a class. Let's ask your group. Do you care about her struggles with math and reading about it? And they're like, yeah, because then it taps into me. It's like, absolutely. That's why we write. That's why we share. It's because it is a universal experience. Life is an individual and universal experience. And so when I say I had to really swallow my fears and just dive into what I loved, and really for the first time test my belief that it would get me somewhere better than if I hadn't, you just got to lean into that. That's a universal truth. That's a theme that others can use as their own armor, their own tools, their own guidebook for living life. And that's the value of it, right?
I think it's a common human experience to question your relevance. And that's the self-doubt, self-saboteur of, am I worthy? Am I good enough? Is my story of value? That must come across the minds, especially of writers, and I'm thinking especially of poets, the same as any kind of artist, right? Anybody who is putting something out there that is always so deeply personal. The last episode that I just did was with a musician, and I briefly touched on it. Anything creative, I would love to touch on faith in a little bit, because I think that that's an important part of your story. But it goes hand in hand with, we can have an intention of what we want to bring through the work that we're creating. But then that intention is usually coming from our thinking mind. But then there's this other part of us that is where inspiration comes through. Once you bring the intention forward to say, I'm going to write, or I'm going to paint, or I'm going to create this, and then you let it flow, what comes out is something so far beyond what I like to think of as the thinking mind. It is actually part of your soul.
Yeah. We were talking about this. I mean, this was the beautiful conversation we had on Thursday. And why do we do it? Why do we write? There's nothing like it. It's like dancing. It's any kind of generative, creative, artistic, athletic endeavor. You are so in touch with yourself and beyond. It's the beyond that I want to get to. And that's a method for it. And yeah, your intention is this. And I said, do I mind? I said, that's the best thing about our form of art, which is why we have to have image in our art. Our art as writers, our audience participates in a way that no other art audience does. When I tell a story, my reader is picturing it in their minds. Our art does not directly play on any of the senses. The closest thing is poetry and rhythm and sound on our hearing. But that's why the impact of writing is so strong because, man, when we hear those stories, we built that story with the writer, right? We built it in our own minds with our own set of tools, and they fed us little parts of it. They gave us kind of like a map, and we are a skeleton, a framework. And then we're like, oh yeah, this is the detail. This is the color hair. Oh, this is exactly the way this house is shaped. They've told me, they've given me some images to hold on to, but they don't tell me too much. They let me participate too. And then we create it with them. And this idea that it has its own sense of life. I have an intention for this poem, and a lot of people will think it means one thing. And I'm like, okay, great. Have at it. But I hope that there's a little bit of this thing in there too, because that was my intention. And that's what we were talking about, like letting go of. We build something and we want people to live in it. We also understand that they're going to have a different experience just because what they bring to building that with us is their own experience. And we can't control that. And I can't guess that. I can't know that. I mean, I could have assumptions. So I have my audience in mind, but I know it's going to live in places very different from where it was born in myself. And my own experience and my own orientation or my own mind. And that's okay. Like you were saying, that's kind of the beauty of it, right? Like there's something else there. And how gorgeous, how gorgeous.
Yeah. Oh, I love what you're saying so much. I was reading a book by Marianne Williamson the other day, and she talked about, I think it was releasing one of her books where, and I think this ties in directly to the vulnerability of putting yourself out there, publishing something, whether that's poetry or a blog or you're putting a painting out there or a piece of music, whatever it is that's coming from you and coming from your passion, which is so personal, being able to detach from what other people's feedback is, right? And you were talking about how we come with an intention that this is what it's going to be, but then we have to recognize that whenever someone is interacting with something we've created, we're then co-creating at that stage. Yeah. Because yeah. You said they're bringing their own lens, their understanding, their experience of life. And that is actually extremely beautiful, that something that you can put out there, even if we would label their reaction as negative, I still think that it's beautiful because it's obviously bringing something alive within them that is just an invitation for self-reflection. Whether they do that or not, we have no control over. But I like to think of everything that I interact with as just an invitation to get to know myself better. And so for me, especially when I'm looking at art, and I say art in the widest definition, right? And that encapsulates any kind of creative endeavor where someone is putting something out into the world. That is the constant invitation. It's like, what is this bringing up in me? What am I seeing from it? And that's the same with interactions with people in relationships, with the world around you. Can we just look at everything as an invitation for self-reflection and deepening our knowledge of ourselves and how we see the world? And like you were saying with your teaching, questioning your beliefs, questioning, why do I feel this way about this thing? And I find when I do that, then when I'm putting my own personal stuff out into the world where there's always that feeling of sort of vulnerability, that it allows me to detach from the outcome. We've talked about that several times already. Can you do something for the joy of it without being attached to the outcome once it's out there? And returning back to what Marianne Williamson was saying about her book, she said, it's none of my business once the book is out there. I wrote the book because I had to. But whether someone buys it and puts it on their bedside table and never reads it is none of my business. I think that that's so important for us to realize that when we feel called to create, we just have to trust that it's the joy of creating it that matters the most, not where it's going and what impact it has.
It's the joy of creating that matters the most. I have two things that I've been thinking as I've been listening to your reflections and your perspectives. Well, I was just struck by the word that I'd never really landed on until just now. When you said she released her book, what a word, right? Mm-hmm. She released it. That's what we do, right? As artists, we release it. We let it live with us. We give it birth. We try and shape it. And then we release it. Like it's a book release. It's a poem release. Love that idea. Mm-hmm. I'm going to take a little note right here to talk about that with my students.
Yeah.
I just love that word because they're interviewing authors, published authors and everything. So, okay. And then I've been working with this one student. It's the most extreme case I've seen of this so far. I guess not concerned. I'm interested. I'm curious. We were talking about writer's block. And I said, well, let me tell you my feelings about writer's block. Whenever I've experienced what some would call writer's block, it's not that I don't know what I want to say. I have a lot of things to say, obviously. But it's that I am concerned. My focus is in the wrong place. My focus is on the end product rather than the process. And then I told the story of my beautiful student. I'm so glad I get to work him into this conversation. Graylin Fletcher. We lost him in 2016, but we still have his art. Isn't that what's so beautiful? And I share it with my student who reads it. It's a recording of him reading the poem that he wrote in response to this interaction that he and I had. I was teaching my only summer creative writing class that I've had, and my dean had to talk me into doing it. I'm like, all right, but it's only two nights a week and it's a night class and so I can go to the beach. He's like, okay, yeah, fine, whatever. So I had this class, just like miracles. Like one other student in there, Elvia, oh my gosh, she's now writing plays and she's at a film festival. It's just amazing. Anyway, so Graylin comes to me right before class in the evening, summer evening in Southern California. And he comes to my office and he says, I can't write. He's like, I know I'm supposed to have this piece to share with my group tomorrow night. And I just can't write. And I said, okay, what's going on? He's like, I blocked. I said, here's what I want you to do. I want you to go home and I want you to write me the shittiest poem you can write. I said, I want every cliche you can think of to be in that poem. I want it to rhyme. I want it to have iambic pentameter, that sing-songy voice, whether it's appropriate for whatever you're writing, your subject. Write me the crappiest poem you can. That's what I want to see tomorrow. That is your job. And I still can see his face. He gives me this little smile and he says, all right. And the next night we're like blown away. And this ended up being a poem. He got published in our campus literary magazine and he's read it. It was an audio file. And I share it with my students. That's what we study. I like to celebrate student writing in my class. So when we're talking about whatever element of craft we're talking about, I give them examples and samples of like, oh, here's a poem. Here's a creative nonfiction piece. Here's a fiction text. And I'd like to have my prior students' work that we get as examples. And we have his.
This dark dream sooted in pitch marker upon the whiteboard of a pilgrim's promise. This dark dawn pressing from soil and pushing forth black diamonds into the fields of cotton. Tees and backs branded in iron or Nike. The same as shoes used for shackling feet and shackles that beat shoulders with chips and weight. This dark afternoon delighted in a million men and marching upon George, D.C. These Harlem readings of obsidian angels, their wings of jet blanketing the streets in rebirth, resounding massive black waves of oceanic rifts from New Orleans, Chicago, and Kansas City, too. This dark evening covered as we peel these eyes and pull them off to turn them into television. An episode of Law and Order where the suspect walks away, where metal meets the ribs of a child and bleeds saccharin, poison that feels this night like petrol. During this dark twilight, should I occupy myself in the comforts of a bar and rack myself with spirits and wine over hooded, crooked countertops? Or am I too oblique, too angry, and too scared of the approaching shadow of this dark nightmare?
Waiter, egg whites only on my morning muffin. English, of course. Make my sandwiches, mayo and mustard, vegetables and freedom fries to the side. Butcher the wheat bread, replace it with white. Bleach brown rice covered in sodium chloride. For dessert, a scoop of vanilla topped in macadamia nuts. Nothing more, as my taste is simple and resolve is sweet. No tips, though, because I carry no change.
I have this student right now who was like, I can't write. I don't know what to write. I've never taken a writing class. And I said, okay. And I told her the Graylin story. And I said, write your grocery list. I don't care what you write. Just write anything that's in your head. And she's still struggling, which just breaks my heart for her. But it's that idea of, I know that's what it is. She's so concerned that she wants it to sound a good way. And that's the first quote that I share with my students on the first day of creative writing is the Ira Glass quote that most of what we write is crap and it disappoints us. But our taste and our ear and our sensibility is what got us into the game. And it's excellent, which is why our work disappoints us. I mean, from day one, I say 98% of what you're producing in this class is crap. And you'll never get to that golden 2% if you don't write that 98% that's crap. And we understand when you share with us what you wrote, especially on the fly, if it's a writing warm-up exercise and I ask you to share with a classmate, you don't need to say the disclaimer, like, this is crap. But like, okay, we know that. We know we're reading the 98% that's crap. We're trying to get to the 2% and we're doing it together. And we're getting that feedback from each other. Not just as support, but as ways to get that perspective that you're talking about. You know, it lives outside of us. Our work, we release it. And when we release it, it has a life. And how is it going to do? It's almost like releasing it. I'll use a water metaphor, my favorite. But we release it. Let's see how it floats. Let's see what direction it goes in. Let's see how buoyant it is, you know, but we have to release it to be able to do that and sense that. And then we can bring it back in and kind of refit it and, you know, hone some things. But that idea, and I'm still, like I said, this is the most challenging experience that I've had of a student who is not looking at the process, but looking at the product. And the product is irrelevant. It really is irrelevant. Get into your group, trust. And that's hard. When you don't trust yourself enough to screw it up, that's where the work is, right? Being able to be kind enough, and I'm taking a mindfulness self-compassion course, to be compassionate and loving to yourself enough to let yourself make mistakes, flounder and write that 98% crap, and to just trust that it's there. It's in there. We all create. I'm listening to a book about creativity. We all create. That's what our minds were built to do. We are wired that way. So we just have to take off all that weight, all that sludge, those shackles from our wings. Like when you were saying about learning and seeing through sharing, talking, or writing, I'm looking at this piece of art that's hanging in my house right now that my dear, dear, longtime childhood friend, Anne Ward, check out her work. She's fantastic. Painted. She's an artist. She's a painter. She's a, you know, watercolors. The picture that I chose of hers, like I'm looking around my home. I have gold walls, very light gold, and it takes people a while, like, is there a shimmer on that wall? My first painting I fell in love with, The Hummingbird, it's on gold leaf canvas. Her thing is lemons. The painting that I'm looking at right now are of lemons, and they're bright yellow, and it's full of light. And my whole life and my writing career has been about joy. And I've said that. I've even articulated that to my students when they've interviewed me, asking about my writing process and what I'm writing right now. And I say, all I care about is joy. That's all I care about. I just want to learn how to write joy better because it's really hard. Writing depression, writing sadness, writing regret, writing jealousy and anger and frustration, those are easy. Try writing joy. You know how hard that is? And my two favorite writers write about joy. They have that light. There's light in there. Aracelis Gourmet, Walt Whitman, man, talk about celebrating joy. Talk about celebrating, period. Toni Morrison does as well. And of course, they talk about dark things in contrast, of course. But it's that joy, man. That's why I'm here about everything. Everything. Teaching, writing, living, gardening, cooking. It's all about the joy, those moments, because those are transcendent moments.
That's like the perfect segue into what I wanted to talk about next, because I think this is a much wider conversation to be had about life when we're facing what we would theoretically call fears, right? So whether it manifests as writing block or fear of flying or whatever it might be, the limitations that we place on ourselves because we're attached to the outcome, what it has to look like in order to be successful, or whatever word you choose to use. And this is something that's actually come through our conversation right from the very beginning, is the joy of the journey being present for every little bit along the way and being willing to make mistakes, being willing to realize that also the things that we label as mistakes are not necessarily mistakes at all. In fact, they are just how we learn. We wouldn't turn to a child who's learning to walk and every time they fall down, call it a failure. It's just part of the process. And so I think that we tend to, as we get older, be very unkind to ourselves. And we feel that need to perform and to perform with perfection. And I think that that's extremely unfair to all of us. And you were talking earlier about your beautiful childhood that held so much joy. And I think that your dedication to bringing that joy forward into your life in the ways that you are, whether it's in your sort of grounded everyday experience, but also through your creativity, through your writing. As you said, like, it's really easy to write about suffering and talk about suffering and to focus on the things that have gotten us to where we are. I think part of being human is that we tend to bond over suffering. So how do we see the value of that, but also see the value of bonding over joy, bonding over the things that bring us together, that connect us? So instead of focusing on difference, focus on similarity, focus on unity and wholeness. And one of the things that you brought up there was about your mindfulness course. And I'd love to talk a little bit more about the Mindful Growth Initiative at Fullerton that you're a part of. But I think one of the things that's sort of sitting here in my mind is talking about faith. And I know this is a bit of a, it tends to be a bit of a loaded word, but I like to invite people to get comfortably uncomfortable, or maybe you're not at all, and it's great either way. Once again, just an invitation to get to know yourself better, right? But when we talk about the kindness to ourselves and the faith and trust that if we lean into the things that bring us joy or we feel called to, even if they come with what we might label fear.
Yeah.
What are the tools that we can practice and hone in order to overcome the fear and find faith that as we compassionately create and compassionately seek ways to live a meaningful life? For those that are listening, Tamara and I met becoming meditation teachers. So I know meditation is a huge part of both of our lives. I know that it's been a key tool for me to transform my fear to faith. And faith doesn't have to be religious, although it can be, and that's wonderful. It can also just be a faith in self, a faith in yourself, in your higher self, whichever lands and resonates best for you. So I'd just love to hear from you, Tamara, a little bit about your journey to meditation, and how do you see it as a tool for helping people to maybe transform their fear into faith of some kind?
There were so many things that you said on your way to the question that I really responded to. Like, you asked the question, how do we lean into the joy rather than focusing on the suffering? And I think the answer, and then you asked me a question about my mindfulness journey and my journey of faith, and I think they're the same answer. Mm-hmm. The way you lean into joy rather than suffering and sorrow, which is seemingly more prevalent but is not actually, is by being mindful of, that's the first step. You have to think about, where is my mind? What am I thinking? Because to me, of course, everything I say is based on just personal experience, so It's just mine. When I am on automatic pilot, my mind is built, it's designed to focus on the negative. I mean, that's a negativity bias. I taught a course, one of my composition courses, and I framed it around the theme of happiness. So everything we read, everything we wrote was about happiness. We looked at the biology of happiness and we talked about the negativity bias, which our amygdala is designed to look for danger at all times, even in the middle of, right in the middle of an orgasm. Like, even then, your brain is looking for danger. That's its job. It's kept the species going. That's our reptilian brain. We have to understand that's how we're hardwired. So we're going to be looking for fault all the time because it's what kept us alive. And that's the jobs of our mind and our body is to keep itself going. Bringing that awareness that, hey, what are my default modes? My default mode network, right? My DMN. When is that present and when is it not? And how can I get more active living going? Because the minute we become curious, the minute we become mindful, our brain releases very different chemicals. Oh, okay, that's growing our mind and our body and keeping the species alive. So let's go there because that's going to pump out those feel-good chemicals. Happiness is a reward system. Our body gives us happiness as reward for different behaviors that will keep it alive. So whenever we're thinking novelty, you know, new, whenever we're being creative, when we're getting into that state of flow, usually that state of flow involves either a deep groove in our mind where we are really, our mind is just firing. The fastest way to get the biggest impact and biggest release of feel-good chemicals like oxytocin and dopamine and serotonin and endorphins is through being with someone else. You know, we're meant to be together. So just bringing that consciousness to and that awareness to where is my mind right now? And am I default mode network thinking? Am I always looking for danger? Am I focusing on that negativity bias like my brain is going to do when I'm not actively directing it? And if so, okay, how can I actively direct it? You know, and where am I actively directing it? And are those behaviors, are those mental exercises, what are they building? Because whatever we practice grows stronger. Whatever we practice, we build. The mind is a muscle like any other muscle in our body. So whichever we're working out, we're building. And whatever we're not working out is decaying. I think that how we lean into more joy is by looking for it and by understanding that our brains are meant to go negative, which is why it does. And when we're not actively directing, it's either just neutral, which that's ideal. It's not the default, unfortunately. Or it's in the negative thinking, a negative cycle. And so that was my journey to mindfulness. I started mindfulness meditation because I had this fear of flying. And I'm a professor and I get 3 months off in the summer and a month off in winter break. Out of the year, I teach 8 months and I have 4 months off. I should be traveling. And I love to travel. And now I do travel. It's another thing that I do. I lead trips with an education travel company. I recruit travelers and help them prepare for travel because I love to prep for things. So that's my downtime. That's my default mode network. Like, let's get busy traveling, planning a travel. So I just started meditating because I knew that if I could control my mind and my response to that situation that seems triggering to me, then I could fly again. And I used to fly before I had that panic attack when I was 32. I studied abroad. I traveled internationally. I took a group of high school students over to Europe. So I just started meditating for a few minutes a day. And then about 2 years later, I took my first turnaround flight to San Francisco. And then I did my East Coast friend who I had told, I will never come and see your family farm. I will never be able to fly and see you in Virginia. And then I did. And then I did my orientation tour with the company I work for now and went to Europe. And I was like, can I do this? And I did it very well. And I continue to do it well. Just all those things kind of lined up like a zipper, you know, like all these other parts of my lives were of my lives. That's fair enough to say lives. Okay. Yep. We're aligning like a multi-teethed zipper. And they just kind of came together. So my teaching kicked in and my mindfulness kicked in and my traveling kicked in and all these things aligned. That's kind of where I'm at now. And it's funny because I'm a little bit all over the place, But also, thanks to this podcast discussion, realizing that it's all about joy. Like, that's my pursuit. My pursuit is relentless in moments of joy because I've had them. Maybe that's where the faith comes in, is that I've had those moments. And having that transcendent experience is joyful for me. That was part of my upbringing, is I have this beautiful experience of a faith community. And it really was a community wherever we were at. It happened to be Catholic, but it was Jesuit Catholic. It was at the local Jesuit university, Loyola Marymount, with a priest who is no longer a priest, left the ministry because he couldn't in good conscience move forward with the theology and the rules of the Catholic Church as he learned more of somebody who clearly was deeply committed on a personal level, not to an institution, but to an internal guidance and that attitude about faith. So that was my model. And that was my experience. That was my initial experience of faith. So it was like, oh my gosh, it's amazing. Of course. Yes, sign me up. And then that was part of the loss. We stopped going to that church because my Catholic school said, you know, you need to come and go to our church. It's like, oh, great. Where you scream at everybody and tell women to take their crying babies into the cry room. Like, it just, come on. Very different from being invited to sit on the altar while a priest gives a sermon. But those moments of, it was just relentless joy. I mean, running as a kid, running 6 blocks. That's what I used to play at home. I didn't play school. I played church.
Interesting.
Yeah. And loved everything about it and would sing the songs. It just, all of it, it was my world. And then that faded because we had to go back to my school's church. And it's like, dang, and that just dissolved. And I think that's the nature of things, is that life is transitory. So these moments that I hold on with my neighbors, every day, I'm very aware that I'm on borrowed time with this beautiful configuration we have here. I'm always trying to create it in all the spaces I work in, that I live in, all the spaces I live in. It's just joy, 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 because negativity bias is there. That's the default. Even the most recent television show, and I'm not a TV watcher, as you can imagine. I don't have a lot of time for TV. If I'm not doing my job or getting ready for a trip or working as a volunteer, growing a garden for a local restaurant or doing my meditation practices and stuff, I don't have a lot of time. But Ted Lasso. And what I loved about that show was that they didn't go for default mode network responses. I was always delighted, that light, that levity, that joy, at how the characters managed responses to triggering situations, especially. It wasn't the opposite. It was just a totally different direction. The default mode network says, no, threaten. But no, let's just say the truth. And the boss confesses to Ted that she hired him to destroy the team, and she thought he would fail, and she thought he was a joke. And she confesses that she did this. And she's like, and you are all such beautiful people. And I did this to you. And he just says, I forgive you.
Mm-hmm.
And she's like, what? She's like, I understand if you want to quit. He's like, no, I forgive you. He said, divorce is hard. And she just throws her arms around him.
A big part of what you're talking about for this entire last piece is about kindness and kindness to others, but kindness to yourself. And I think one of the greatest gifts we can give ourselves is a better understanding of our inner workings. I'm really grateful that you did a little bit of that here in terms of helping to understand that our brains have this natural default mode. I think the more that people can learn about their nervous system, the more they can learn about the way that the brain operates, the better, because then we can actually be kind to ourselves when we find ourselves going down that autopilot route. We can celebrate when we pattern interrupt. That becomes your dopamine. Oh, wow. I just interrupted a pattern. I just took that space. I took a pause. And for me, the exploration of meditation has come in so many, wow, so many different shapes and forms. I think doing the course that we did with the Lab of Meditation with Hero was a game changer for me. And I know that we've talked a lot about that. Both of us kind of went in not really sure what to expect. And I think both of us were very transformed by the process. For me, meditation, being present with your life, being mindful, whatever word you choose to use, is not about the practice on the mat. That's why we call it practice. Where it actually matters is in our lived experience every day, in relationship and connection with one another, so that we can pause. I love the Viktor Frankl quote, "Between stimulus and response, there is a space. And in that space is our power to choose our response. And our response lies our growth and our freedom." Because the more that we can create that space with the better understanding of our inner landscape, who we are, what conditioning have I picked up along the way? What are my beliefs? And question them. As you said, lead with curiosity. How do we basically get back to the way we were when we were kids? That open-mindedness, that open-heartedness to one another, to be honest even when it's scary, to disrupt the norm, and to get a little bit weird. Get out of the character that we're playing so that we can better understand who we truly are. And I think who we truly are is love and kindness and acceptance. And that goes hand in hand with that faith and trust in ourselves that we can lean into joy and that it is our responsibility to share that joy with others.
The only way you build it, the only way you build anything is by doing it. So the only way you build trust is by doing things that challenge that trust in yourself, in others, in the world, your perceptions. That's the only way you build that.
Mm-hmm.
That's my critical thinking class. That's where we start. Personal bias, like understand yourself, what your triggers are, where you come from, your perspective. This will never be a class where we debate, ever. We are more interested in finding out about ourselves as critical thinkers, what we think, how we think, why we think, before we ever begin to engage in any kind of public arena, our thoughts when we create arguments. But I rewrote these presentation assignments. And what I'm trying to do is build that space, like you were talking about the Viktor Frankl quote. We're going to pick these, you know, hot button topics. And I want each group to research a different perspective on it. And we're going to present all the perspectives. And as the audience, people not in the group, I'm going to ask you to figure out to rank the different perspectives in one's order of allegiance of what you agree to, right? Like, oh yeah, I agree with this. I really disagree with this. And then I'm going to ask you to be aware, to bring awareness into those perspectives that you completely disagree with and that actually threaten you, perspective, your sense of self, whatever, your ego, whatever. I want you to learn to build a space between what you hear, what you experience, and your response to it. Yes to everything you said. I mean, all of it. A big takeaway for me on this is just my commitment to joy and how, for me personally, now it's going to be about bringing a new level of consciousness to living between the spaces of joy. And being able to reach out for the next one with some kind of faith without clutching for it, reach in a direction that is entirely different because I can't repeat anything and I don't want to. But looking into myself and saying, where is it going to be coming from next? And as I can to influence its direction and its shape, with also being open to considering the newness of where it will be and what it will look like and being surprised at where I find that joy. It's like planning for it by just leaning into knowing it when I see it. You know what I mean?
And also just trusting yourself that you will know when you see it. And I think that it's interesting. You're at a transitional time in your life with regards to your career and what you want to do next as well. What I see when I look at what you're doing right now is you're actually curating joy in all aspects of your life. You're curating it in your community in terms of your crop swap, and you're inviting people over with a plate to come and get some food that you've made, whether it's in your volunteering for the kitchen garden at Alder and Sage Restaurant, whether it's boating and taking people out on the ocean and letting them have that experience. It's in the way that you teach and you have these relationships with these students that are returning back to your own reflections on the teachers that stand out in your mind. And I know that that is a huge formative experience for most people, as we can all bring to mind that teacher that saw the potential in you when you couldn't see it in yourself. It's an integral part. And whether that's a formal teacher or it's informal, whether it's a coach or perhaps it's your spiritual leader, or maybe it's even a camp counselor, like you don't know where that's going to come from. But as I look at this, and as you're saying, you know, I'm realizing that that joy is foundational. And the same with your mindful growth initiative and the Serenity Garden that you're making at Fullerton College. I mean, it's not about just waiting for that next thing to bring you joy. It's about curating joy within and allowing that to spread out into everything that you do.
Yeah. As when I taught the happiness class, I'd say it takes effort. It's not our default. It comes so readily when we have curated it. It's surprising and spontaneous. But you do have to do some work. You do. If you want to be happy, you have to be committed to that. Somebody asked me, a student asked me last semester, turned in, and he said, Trujillo, can I ask you a question? It's totally off topic. And I said, yeah, sure. And he said, how are you so happy? He's like, I mean, like, it's genuine. How are you so happy? And I just started laughing, which kind of, you know, made his point. I said, that is so funny, because this has been one of the hardest semesters, just for personal reasons. I said, you know, in response to that, I would say I have a very curated life. I'm very careful about what I ingest, what I bring into my life. I said, I don't listen to or watch the news. I read it so I can filter and I can pace. My social media is only animal videos and recipes. You know, all of those things, my relationships, what I do, how I spend my time, very careful about my pacing. But I think now my question I walk away with, and this is very personal. I don't know that this is completely aggrandizing and it's completely selfish for me to share this, because I don't know that this will be any fruit for any of your podcast listeners. But for me now, it's like, okay, so what do I do with my time in between those joyful moments? I recognize right now that I'm not in a joyful moment. I mean, there are moments, you know, overall, it's not the daily experience of joy that I'm trying to build. I'm not there yet. What do I do in the meantime that won't drain my resources for when I'm in those moments of joy, and that will optimize my chances of living in joy? What am I doing right now? And again, that's just being very mindful. What are my thoughts? What are my actions? How am I using all of my resources, my time, money, energy?
You say that that's actually a selfish thing. I don't think it is at all. It's something that we can all reflect on. How do we find compassion for ourselves? How do we trust that we're exactly where we're supposed to be, and that joy isn't necessarily out there? It's not in the future. It can be right here, but also not to feel like we're failing when we're not joyful. To actually celebrate all of the emotions. Believe that we signed up to feel the whole spectrum, and that no matter what you're feeling, it's valid and it has value as long as you're taking the time to be mindful of it, to sit with it, and really ask yourself, what is this teaching me?
Yeah. And I think too, for me, how am I building it? Those moments where I'm not in the moment of joy, those crunchy moments, as our hero.
Yes.
Our hero.
The crunchy moments. I love the crunchy moments.
Just being aware of the opportunity in those crunchy moments, knowing it's almost like they're down times. Okay. These are my building times. Mm. Like, not a waste. Nothing's ever a waste. That can get me to a feelings of just drudgery and depression, you know, just hopelessness, despair, faster than anything is feeling like I've wasted something. Regret can be relentless, but just seeing that, okay, those could be teaching moments for myself. And now as I'm in between those moments of joy, taking in those little moments when they come, because they'll always be there, right? I can always choose to be grateful for the meal I just ate and really being present when I'm enjoying the delights of that, understanding that there is a lot of the population that will never have consistent access to food. You know, in my garden, the joy that I'm feeling of it is just, oh, it's wonderful. Or the moments with things that I'm aware are transitory, as everything in life is transitory. I just told my students that. In between those moments where it's tempting to just do the default mode network, that's where I really need to lean into my awareness, where I really need to be mindful and present so that I can consciously build for the next time. Like, what am I doing in those moments? Am I being the best friend to myself that I can be so that when those moments come, I am at my optimum? We're asked to post to a forum every week for our assignment in this mindfulness self-compassion course I'm taking. And we have to comment on other people's posts. And one of my classmates said something about, I'm offering it to myself. And I said, isn't that wonderful? We are taught to really take care of others, oftentimes at the ignorance or expense of ourself. And that when we lean into this idea that common humanity that is fundamental to self-compassion, this idea that I'm not the only one suffering, which brings relief to that, that there's a kindness in that, I'm aligned with other people, I'm in concert with other people, I'm really learning how to take care of me, and that I'm offering myself this distance with myself. Am I in my top game so that when those moments come, will I be able to maximize the joy that will be there? Lean into it and build it as a constant, because that's my goal, is to build it as a constant situation so that when life happens, I have the base, home base that is just joy.
Wow. I love that so much. And just, it is the perfect time for me to ask you one final question.
Okay.
What do you think is the meaning and purpose of life, the universe, and everything?
Oh my gosh. I'm going to say one word that is, I think, a synonym for the word we've been talking about this entire podcast. I would say love. Wherever that leads, I don't know. I think it leads to life after. I think that's where what we bring with us to transcendence. I think that's the only thing we bring with us in transcendence is love. And I think joy, to me, that's the state of love.
That's beautiful, Tamara. Thank you so much for your time today. This has been wonderful. So before we sign off, I would love to know what cause you've chosen for the Recreation donation this month.
Well, it was hard because I've worked with lots of different volunteer organizations. All of them are so worthy. But what came to mind after consideration was this nonprofit. It's called CAMP, C-A-M-P, and that stands for Community Animal Medicine Project. And it's about community, and they provide access to affordable veterinarian services in underserved areas in Los Angeles and Orange County. And it just helps keep pets and their people together. And I remember when I was working at Cat Rescue and Animal Rescue for 10 years, over 10 years, we would always take our animals to camp for spay neuter. And anytime they needed any medicine or any medical treatment, I had a cat adopt me raiding in my backyard. And it was in the summertime, and a cat just jumped over the fence and just came and sat on my lap. And it turns out we never found the home. Didn't have a microchip or anything. Turns out that cat was pregnant. So I took her to my vet and I said, do you think she's pregnant? And the vet was like, you know, we can't really be sure with a blood test. 2 days later, she gave birth.
Right.
So yeah. When I went to go have her and her two little adorable kittens that I actually adopted out to former student, I took them to camp because I knew that they do everything and it's affordable and they're trustworthy. And what happened is Mama Kitty, when they were expressing her bladder to do the surgery, it ruptured. And they were so great. They called me and they said, come get the kittens. They said, we just want your permission to take her to a specialist in the next city over, and we'll rush her by ambulance, and, you know, she'll get all the care and everything. And I was like, oh my gosh, what's this going to cost me? And they said, oh, nothing. Oh, it's not going to cost you anything. They covered all the costs. And I just thought, holy cow, who is this group? So anytime that I've coached somebody through adoption of an animal, I always say, go to camp, get them spay neutered, get all their tests, their shots, everything through them, because they are just wonderful. And it really is affordable. Sometimes they do clinics where you can get your pet spay or neutered for like $20 or something. They are such animal advocates and they're out there. They do a lot of unhoused population outreach with their pets and food and supplies. And I'm so happy that I thought of them because they are such a worthy cause and I'm grateful that we get to support them. So thank you.
Thank you so much for choosing them. I know that you have a very important animal in your life, lovely Anna. I've been very fortunate to have animals in my life as well. So I think anybody listening will completely understand how important this type of work is for, as you said, keeping pets and their people together. Thank you for choosing this cause. I am so excited to support it. And I just want to say what a beautiful visit this has been. We've delved deep and we've felt many emotions, I think, in having this conversation. And I'm so grateful to you for being here with me, for co-creating this episode. And I look forward to more chances to have these beautiful conversations together.
What a gift. I have had such a great time, as always, with you. And it's just been a really great opportunity. I'm grateful to be able to review and look at my life with a different lens. I mean, because we're always in it, right? We're always swimming in the water and it's kind of neat to be on shore now and look back and say, oh, what are the touch points of my life and where's it going? I think that's what I'm most excited about is after this reflection and this opportunity to reflect, it's just letting me reset my GPS. Like, where am I headed? Where am I going? So I'm grateful. Thank you.
This month's recreation donation is in support of CAMP, Community Animal Medicine Project in Los Angeles. As you now know from exploring with Tamara and I in this episode, this charity works to provide access to affordable veterinary services in underserved areas, helping to keep pets and their people together where they belong. They treat over 80,000 pets annually, not only providing low-cost veterinary care, but they also believe that no pet should suffer nor be turned over to a shelter because their family can't afford veterinary care. They have spayed and neutered over 300,000 cats and dogs and offer free spay and neuter vaccines where possible, preventing millions of pets being born into homelessness and helping cut the euthanasia rate in half in LA shelters. Whether you can volunteer your time, money, or your voice, we hope you'll head over to our Patreon page to find out the different ways you can support their unique version of recreation for the world. Please take the time to let us know what the stories we explored in this episode meant to you, and if you do take action to support this month's cause, thank you. Thanks for joining us for this episode of Recreation to Recreation. If you, or someone you know, has a unique and inspiring story to tell, make sure to reach out so we can share it with the world. Until next time, keep happy, keep healthy, and keep exploring.